For the week of August 12th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 419, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz.
How you doing there in Allentown, Pennsylvania? I guess you were in New York. Is that
That's right. I had to renew my driver's license, get some business cards, do a little this, a little that. So I spent about 5 days in New York City, had a great time. I love New York. I went to a free concert at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine up on Amsterdam and 112th Street. That was a premiere, a New York premiere of a concert by John Adams, the composer. It included 600 voice choir, 14 conductors. The choirs were placed all over the cathedral. You could wander around and listen in and stand right behind the choir members and watch the guy conducting them and wander anywhere and everywhere. And then halfway through, the choir started to move as well. So it was a very hip, cool New York thing to do on a Saturday afternoon. And then Sunday night, I went to see Margot Price, the country singer, at Lincoln Center Outdoors. I saw some movies. It was just a great weekend. I was going to go see Harry Potter on Broadway. The possibility of tickets were dangled in front of me, and then they were snatched away.
What moron would do? What evil person would do that to you?
Cruel person named Sperling would do such a thing.
Okay, look, I had two extra tickets, but they were very expensive. I had to sell them at a huge loss, I might add.
Yeah, see, you would have been better off just giving them to me.
I probably would have. I would have felt better about it, that's for sure.
That's for sure. So you did go to see Harry Potter, and I think you saw Hello, Dolly as well. You were in New York, though we didn't cross paths. What did you think? How was your weekend in New York?
My weekend in New York was great. I mean, I guess, well, you mentioned Harry Potter. I have to say I'm not allowed to talk about it according to all of the hashtag warnings on the outside and inside the theater, on the playbill and the buttons they gave out as you entered and exited the theater. We're not allowed to talk about it, even though the play has been published as a book 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's really not the plot you're not supposed to talk about as such, but the mechanics of it, how they do the show, the fun, old-fashioned tricks they use to tell the story. So I think it's the theatrical imagination that they want you not to, not that you want to give away all the plot, but, you know, did you have fun? You can certainly talk about that.
Yeah, I have to say, I didn't read the book, didn't read the play beforehand, and I was not looking forward to sitting through not one, but two different plays in the course of one day. We're talking about 5.5 hours worth of plays in one day. But I have to say, the stagecraft that you're mentioning is absolutely amazing. And I'm not going to give away anything and tell you how they did things, because frankly, I don't know how they did some of those things.
Was it theater, or did it feel more like a theme park ride?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because walking into the lobby of the Lyric Theater in New York, I realized, wow, they have redone this entire theater from the carpeting up. You look at the carpeting, it's got little H's for either Harry Potter or Hogwarts. You look at the wallpaper, all these little tiny things. If you look in corners and nooks, and you can see that they've taken the time, the way Disney would at one of its theme park rides, to do just that, to kind of turn the whole theater into a Harry Potter experience. And, you know, normally when you walk into a theater, you can see the lights dangling and some of the scaffold, you know, you can see you can see some of the lights that are meant for the stage, you know,
Oh, you said dangling, like they're about to fall.
No. Okay. No, okay. But you know, you can see some of the rigging, so to speak. There is none of that here. And partly because
it's a choice. It's a choice that they make if they show the rigging. Yeah. It's not like, oh, well, they didn't bother. Right, it's a choice. Yeah.
Right, and everything is hidden. It looks like a nice old theater, and it's a pretty big theater. And
oh, it's a monster. It's the biggest on Broadway. That's where Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, was ensconced.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. I looked that up, and I thought it was somewhere else, the Foxwoods. I thought that's where
No, it's
it was the Lyric?
Yeah, it's where Spider-Man was.
Okay. Well, I can see why it was there. And certainly, did it need to be 5.5 hours long? Did it need to be two different plays? Probably not. After the first play, there's no curtain call. There's no, you know, nobody comes out and takes a bow. Because
it's not, the story's not over.
Right. And it even says to be continued. But all of the special effects, and I mean, it's pretty darn impressive. The story could have been a little shorter, that's for sure.
Okay. So that was when you recommend it?
I would recommend it, especially if you have children, because there were a lot of people who didn't even know, didn't like Harry Potter at all, who were like, wow, this is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, a Broadway experience I will never forget. And Michael, you know, I've lived in New York for 20 some odd years. I've seen Broadway productions with Patti LuPone, Chita Rivera, some of the, you know, signature roles that they performed. And it was stunning. They were amazing. But I have never been in a moment like I was when I saw Hello Dolly and Bette Midler sang the title song. It was as if you were back in the 1960s and the Beatles were on stage. I mean, people leapt to their feet after she was done, and it was an amazing performance. When you think, I mean, it was just, she's in her 60s or, yeah, I think she's in her 60s. She did a bang-up job in that role.
And the show over, it just felt like, was it all Bette Midler, or was it, she's 72, by the way, but was it just Bette Midler, or was it the show, or was it everything, or, you know?
Look, the show was never a big show, right? I mean, it was never a show.
It was a monster. It was one of the biggest hits of all time.
Well, I mean, but it was never a show that people thought like, oh, you know, this is a classic show. It's not a Sound of Music where, you know, the story is so great.
Well, it's a very popular show.
Correct.
It's been a vehicle for actresses for many years. It has some, you know, memorable numbers, but yeah, it's not critically acclaimed as such, though I'm sure it won, you know, was up for best musical and all that. But yes, it is certainly a big, big popular show.
Right, which means it could probably win the Tony Award for most popular musical, but that's another story.
we'll get to that.
Exactly. Let's not talk about that now. But yeah, no, I mean, it was not necessarily all Bette. There were some numbers without her, but what's his name was in it? Hyde Pierce, David Hyde Pierce, the mm-hmm. from Frasier, and yeah. He was phenomenal. And I've seen him numerous times in different plays and musicals, and he's always amazing. And he really held up his own against Bette Midler. But I have to say, she just knew how to work that stage, and she owned that role. And it was kind of an out of body experience to see that performance and that particular actress do that. It was absolutely amazing.
That's why people go to live theater. And by the way, in 1964, Hello Dolly won 10 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, Best Book, Best Actress for Carol Channing, and on and on and on.
What won in 1965?
I don't know.
I was just trying to throw you for a loop. How'd I do?
You did just fine. So that's what happened when you went to New York. What's going to happen on our show today?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to discuss the Paramount decree, or decrees as I now understand them to be, and how the Trump Justice Department may ditch one of the longest standing rules on how Hollywood does business. The result? Studios might start buying up theater chains again. And actually, I just saw a donkey fly by my window and a chicken with lips pass by the studio. In China news, the box office enjoyed its biggest month ever in July, topping $1 billion. Thank you, illegal drug smugglers. And if you want to know why we said that, stay tuned. Meanwhile, MoviePass changed its rules again, and then again, but this time they really mean it. The one movie a day service is now the one movie every 10 day service. Will customers stick with it? And now that Jeffrey Katzenberg has raised more than $1 billion, we finally got a clearer picture of what new TV will be. And by the way, don't call it new TV. In book filter news, Michael has a rousing tale of Norse adventurers battling to unite a kingdom into one country. In sexual misconduct news, we discover CBS has hired not one, but two law firms to look into Les Moonves, Charlie Rose, and a culture of harassment at the network. In related news, the head of 60 Minutes decided to extend his family vacation. I'm surprised the word permanently isn't following that sentence. In Inside Baseball, we talk about the Academy Awards and the train wreck of an announcement about changes being proposed for one of, if not the most famous award show in the world. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, You Are Listeners, And if you wanted to make the charts this week, to be in there at number 23, you'd have to gross $3 million. That's where you'll find Teen Titans Go to the Movies. They have hit $30 million, so they tripled their budget, so they're doing just fine. If you wanted to hit the top 10, you had to gross $15 million this week. That's where you'll find The Spy Gone North. That's a Korean drama based on the true story of a South Korean spy who infiltrated a North Korean nuclear facility. And that opened nicely to $15 million. But if you want to be the number one movie in the world, you needed a really, really big shark. That's where you'll find The Meg, the Jason Statham thriller, Jaws times 10, I guess we'll call it, $141 million worldwide. Boy, the predictions were off on this one. Talk about tracking being way, way off. They were like, oh, The Meg, I don't know. It's going to open weekly, maybe 20. And then in North America, it did $44 million. Worldwide, it did $50 million in China. Total overall, $140 million.
I don't understand how the tracking could be off so badly on this film. This film was marketed, like, for the past 6 months. I think it had and I might be wrong about this, a trailer on the Super Bowl. I'm probably wrong about that. But literally, this movie, the number of trailers in before summer releases was, I mean, it was before every summer release. And people were actually really excited about it when the trailer came on. They were like, oh, I want to see that. That looks good. You could, you know, all you have to do is sit in the audience and watch the trailers with the audience, and you'll know which movies are going to do well.
And it's not like it was better or worse than people expected. It was exactly what people expected, a big, dumb movie with a big, giant shark.
Right. You know, the one thing I didn't expect was for it to pander to the Chinese audience so much, where, like, you know, half
I wouldn't say pander.
Okay,
don't
fine.
Say pander.
I guess really it, what I'm saying
half
is...
half the financing came from China,
right,
and some of the significant characters were Chinese. So what?
Right, and they basically built it so that it could slide under that 34... even though, let's face it, that quota doesn't really exist anymore. It exists in name only, but it slides right under that quota because, of course, it's half financed by Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. So a big, big success for The Meg. It's not done yet. Of course, it cost $130 million to make. If it falls off a cliff next weekend, which is certainly possible in North America, I don't think it's going to do lots of repeat biz. You know, we'll have to see where it ends up, but it's certainly a solid start.
Did you see the movie?
No, I did not. You know, MoviePass said I could go if I paid $8.
You know what? The weird thing is, it was literally like one of the only movies I could see on MoviePass.
Understand. On the weekends, they are still blocking virtually everything.
Yeah.
They blocked all the art houses in New York except for like one movie at one place. And they blocked most of the big first run movies. Or they said, well, they didn't list them. Or they said, well, you can see The Meg, but you have to pay $8. I mean, I did see a couple movies. I saw First Reformed with Ethan Hawke. I saw RBG, but that was playing at an affiliated theater, the Landmark at 57th Street, which they have a deal with.
Okay.
So that's one reason why those movies were accessible. Well, here's a confusing movie at number two. At number one was The Meg with $140 million. At number two, this is getting a little murky here. It's called iPartment, sort of like apartment, but like maybe created by Apple. It has a little I in front of it, but it's called iPartment. It grossed $80 million. Now, iPartment is a long-running Chinese sitcom that basically has been a hit but been lambasted for ripping off Friends specifically and lots of American sitcoms. They literally would just take gags and jokes written for Friends or How I Met Your Mother and translate them into Chinese and put them on their show. I mean, that's what people have been saying. So that's that show. It's been a big hit in China for like 6 or 7 years. And yet, this movie is not the feature film version of that TV show. It apparently, if I'm getting this right, includes characters from the show, but they've been thrown into a Tomb Raider comedy type fantasy action film. So it's as if Ross and Rachel suddenly went tomb raiding. Suddenly they were in a Raiders movie, but with jokes. It's bizarre. And so fans were furious. They were furious that they expected to see a feature film version of their hit TV show. It's the same name, for God's sakes, the same actors, I think. And instead, it's just this completely unrelated Tomb Raider comedy. So that was bizarre. Meanwhile, other studios are accusing the people behind this film of buying $15 million worth of tickets to boost the opening day numbers. Which
wow.
is bizarre because it's grossed $80 million. So if you were going to gross $65 million, is that so bad? You know, I think they made a big mistake in doing that. It indeed happened. So lots of question marks circling around iPartment. Talk about, you know, you know, copyright protection and intellectual property. This movie has it all in spades. And number three around the world is The Island, another Chinese film. This is a comedy and drama about an office worker who sits around dreaming of winning the lottery. I know how he feels. And yet that has nothing to do with the movie. In the movie, he is stranded on an island with his coworkers. I'm not sure how that comes about, what the connection is, but it made $77 million. So if iPartment did indeed boost its ticket sales by $50 million, that's the only reason they're ranked ahead of The Island.
So does he dream about a winning the lottery so he can buy a boat? I don't get it.
That would make sense. At number four is Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible Fallout. $58 million on the weekend. They're at $440 million worldwide.
You know, MoviePass sent me an email yesterday that said Tuesday night's mission, and then in parentheses, impossible. And I said, let me get this straight. You don't want me seeing Mission Impossible, but now you do want me seeing Mission Impossible, but only on Tuesday night. I don't get it.
Tuesday at AMC, movies are $5 if you're an AMC member.
Oh, okay.
Are you?
I am, but not the A-list. I'm on the,
if you're just on the free list thing, it's $5.
No, I'm on the premium, premier club or whatever that you pay.
That's what I did too. But if you just sign up for free on Tuesdays, you can see movies for $5.
Okay. So it's like a Super Tuesday.
At all AMC theaters. Yeah. At number five is Mamma Mia. Here we go again. $27 million on the weekend, $280 million worldwide, well back from the first Mamma Mia film. And number six is the Adam Sandler animated flick Hotel Transylvania 3, $22 million on the weekend, $380 million worldwide. So another big success story for Adam Sandler. And number seven is The Incredibles 2. We think it cost about $200 million. It's past the $1 billion mark. It's at $1,088 million. And number eight, slightly less successful, is Disney's Christopher Robin. $16 million on the weekend. It's at $62 million worldwide. Been received pretty indifferently, I would say. And since it costs $70 million to make, it's going to be a long haul before this movie gets into the black. And number nine is Along with the Gods, The Last 49 Days. This is really part two of one big movie. The first one was called Along with the Gods. It had a subtitle, but they were both filmed at the same time. I'm guessing the budget that we're given of $36 million is for each part, but I don't really know. It grossed $16 million on the weekend. It opened up last week while we were off because of Sperling, and it is at $63 million. So it's doubled its budget, just about. And it's going along fine, so we'll have to see where it ends up. But it's part two of a two-parter sort of movie, Along with the Gods. It's based on a webtoon, as I recall. And basically, they're Grim Reapers, except usually the Grim Reaper is skeletal and scary. And these are young, sexy Grim Reapers, so they're shepherding their souls to the afterlife. So that's the sort of basic premise of the movie. Last weekend was also the opening of The Spy Who Dumped Me, a comic action film starring Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon, and if you're like most of the women in my life, also starring Sam Heughan of Outlander. That's all anybody cared about. $11 million on the weekend, $31 million and counting. The budget was $40 million, so kind of a weak start for that movie. We'll have to see if it can pull it out with overseas box office. I'm not hopeful. And number 12 is Slender Man, a low-budget horror flick. It cost $10 million to make, and it grossed $11 million on its opening weekend. It is based on an internet meme about scary pasta. People will make a movie about anything.
Scary pasta.
Scary pasta, that's what it is.
You sure it's not a comedy?
I'm pretty sure. And number 13 is the Spike Lee flick Black Klansman. A very solid opening weekend for this movie. Good reviews, good word of mouth. $11 million it made. It cost $15 million to make. So this is a very good launch to a movie that should have very strong legs. I'm looking forward to seeing it, that's for sure. And number 14 is Hello, Mr. Billionaire. $10 million on the weekend, $335 million worldwide. Sperling, you talked about pitching this at Hollywood. I would be careful because, in fact, this is a remake of a Hollywood film. I didn't know this, but it's a remake of Richard Pryor's Brewster's Millions.
Wait, what was the story about, though? Because I do kind of vaguely remember this was like 2 weeks ago we talked about this, right?
Yeah, this is about a guy who inherits money, but he must spend a certain amount within a month.
Oh, yeah.
And, that's right. But he can't tell anybody why he's doing it. I don't understand anything about this premise, but apparently it was a moronic You know, it's this Richard Pryor movie that from 1985 that was,
I do remember that. Yeah, I do remember it's that movie. Yeah.
This is an, I'm sorry, this is the eighth version of this story. It's a novel from 1902 by George Barr McCutcheon, and it's been turned into a film at least eight times now. This, the Richard Pryor film was the seventh version of it. I'm not quite sure what the deal is, but people love this story. they keep remaking it. Who doesn't want to inherit money, I guess, but the premise of having to spend it really quick for a month and not telling anyone, I don't get it. But apparently, this Chinese remake, Hello, Mr. Billionaire, that's just the latest version of a story that's more than a century old.
Well, and these days, you know, all you'd have to do is buy a media company. You'd be through that billion in no time.
Yeah. First, buy a media company? That sounds like the Steve Martin joke of how to make $1 million and not pay taxes. First, get $1 million. Then, it's like, yeah, okay. And number 15 is Ant-Man and the Wasp, another $10 million. That's at $450 million and counting. And number 16 is the Denzel Washington franchise, The Equalizer 2. It's about to pass the $100 million mark worldwide. Looking down, Darkest Minds opened pretty poorly last week. And this is a very lame ripoff of X-Men. It's at $22 million counting in 50 territories, but mostly from North America. Ocean's 8 is still chugging along. That's at $280 million worldwide. And here's another new film. It's, I don't know how to say it. It's really kind of slang for to heck with your mama. It's really screw your mom. But it's a French slang. So it sort of makes a play on words. And this version is actually a sequel. So it's screw your mom. So it's your mama, your mama. Because it's a sequel to a film from 2009 about a teenage kid moving to a nicer neighborhood. You know, a fish out of water, poor person among rich people. This is a sequel. It opened up to $3.2 million in France. And one more movie to talk about. That's The First Purge. We said it would happen, and indeed it did. The First Purge, the fourth film in the franchise, is officially the highest grossing one yet. Every film has made more money than the one before it. And this one isn't done yet. It's at $127 million worldwide. The total budget for all four films is $35 million, and they're just about to hit $500 million in grosses. $500 million from these movies, and now they're turning it into a TV series. Are they killing the goose that laid the golden egg? I don't know.
You know what? Speaking of TV series, I'm just going to go back to that Yo Mama film from France.
Yo Mama.
Yeah, I think that could be a TV series. You know, maybe you take, I don't know, a young teenager from, say, the inner city in Philadelphia, move them to, I don't know off the top of my head, a Bel Air or something like that. You know, that could work.
That'll never work. You know, Sperling, every week it seems you like to mention the Paramount decrees. It makes you happy.
It does.
It gives you joy. And now it may end because the Justice Department said, you know, that's probably outdated. We're going to take a look at that. The Paramount decrees that says you can't have vertical integration in the film industry. You can't be a studio and own theaters. You know, you're not allowed to do that. Well, they are thinking twice about that. And as a result, Warner Brothers might buy Landmark. That's something they're toying with. I don't know how long this review is going to take, but they're going to decide whether this is just outdated because there's so much competition now that it'd be fine if studios own theaters. What do you think?
I think that they're insane. I think the whole idea of vertical, getting away from vertical integration was to stem competition, or not to stem competition, to spur competition. And it's just a stupid idea. I mean, basically, you would be squelching competition. Yes, there's other alternatives. Yes, you can now watch Netflix at home. Yes, there's now Amazon Prime and you can watch, you know, YouTube videos. I get
that's
it.
That's a different business.
That's a different business, correct. And so I think that the reasons that the Paramount decrees were put into place with each of the studios at the time still exists today. Block booking would still be a problem today. And so it's just such a bad idea that, and yes, I know time marches on and sometimes you have to relook at things. But the whole concept of vertical integration and whether it's good or bad for an industry still exists not only in the motion picture business, but elsewhere, as we've seen with the AT&T, Time Warner, and Comcast NBC mergers.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thinks Comcast-NBC merger was a bad idea. They're thinking the same thing about the AT&T-Time Warner merger. So what's the difference here? It's the same concept. You would be owning manufacturing, in this case, the making of content, and the distribution chain, and the retail chain. So you're basically owning the whole pipeline.
Well, they understand that, and they think it's time to get rid of it. Say it's okay, do what you want. They're very they're very pro-trust, I guess.
Yeah,
that's pro-trust. Well, that could shake up Hollywood seriously. In the Middle Kingdom, in China, they had a great July. Their July box office was the all-time record for that month. $1 billion gross in July. If they did that every month, they'd have a $12 billion market, and they would be bigger than North America.
Yeah, that's true. I guess they'd be $12 billion. That's right.
That's right. And another story we've been following, but of course, their box office has been growing by leaps and bounds. It slowed down a little bit last year, but now with an influx of Hollywood movies and new deals to allow more films to come in, they're back on target. They're going to have another year of growth. It won't be as explosive as it was 3, 4, 5 years ago, but they're coming along strong, and it should be within a few years that they are the biggest single market in the world. And that means the more money you make, the more taxes you have to pay. There was a story we were following about celebrities and whether they're hiding their income so that they don't have to pay as much taxes on it. And one of them involved Fan Bingbing. She's a big star in China. And in fact, news has come out that she and her brother, who's also caught up in this tax evasion investigation, they cannot leave China while the investigation continues. So they're like, yeah, you're not going to leave the country right now. So first it started off smearing her. Then the TV host who put it out said, well, it's not necessarily her. No. The government feels like this is a big story, and we'll be hearing more and more about this in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah, and that's one thing you don't want in China is the government taking a closer look at your finances.
And if I could look at the finances of MoviePass, I would be very, very happy. I would love to know how many subscribers do you have, how many are annual subscribers, how many are monthly, how many people have quit.
That's really what I want to know. I want to know how many people have quit.
Right. So I'll set up the new plan, and then you can set up the new plan. MoviePass made a big announcement. They were going to raise the subscription to $15 a month, going to get rid of surge pricing. They said you can't see a first run movie on opening weekend when it's on 1,000 screens or more, at least not for the first or second weekend. Showtimes may change randomly. Make sure you check your app. And it's an outcry. Nobody was happy with this solution. I don't know why. It seemed like a reasonable step. But now they've come up with a new plan. And this one, they swear, is the one they're going to stick with for at least a month.
Yes, they said, we listened, we heard your complaints, and we're going to change. Okay, we're going to change back to what we used to have, except, so we're going to have a $9.95 or $10 per month, okay? And you'll be able to see 3 movies a month. Okay, wait, what?
What?
Yeah.
Instead of a movie a day, you can now see a movie every 10 days.
Right. Well, you could see 3 movies, back to back if you want to, day 1, day 2, day 3. But then you can't see any other movies beyond that. However, you can, and they will be $2 to $5 off per ticket. There will be no surge.
There'll be an extra cost of $2 to $5. Yeah, not $2 to $5 off, but $2 to $5 a ticket. They're not going to say, we don't know. So we can't go into the details too easily because we don't know the details, and they probably don't know the details, and those details will change. Maybe you'll be able to get a ticket for a couple bucks. Maybe you'll have to get a couple bucks discount off the full price. They say they're getting rid of surge pricing. You don't have to take a picture of your receipt anymore. It won't involve all movies all the time. It's, if you bought an annual membership, this isn't going to affect you right away until your membership expires. So basically they're saying, look, 85% of our customers only see 3 movies a month or less. So most of our customers won't be affected. To which I say, hey, 15% is a lot of customers, and that would be the heavy users and the people who love it most. That's me. So that's actually a lot of people when you're affecting, more 1 out of 7 customers. And, it hasn't helped their share price. Their shares were trading at 9 cents the day they announced this new plan because it's the latest one. The biggest problem is uncertainty. Nothing is clear. And it still isn't.
Yeah, that's their big, in my opinion, besides all the financial issues, their biggest problem is they have a reputation issue now. Everybody thinks they're not going to be around for long. Why bother signing up, right? I mean, it's
Well, they got more customers than they need right now. So that's an okay problem to have. But, you know, they claim now they're making $4 to $6 a month per subscriber on ads and other revenue streams. I don't buy that.
I would love to know what... I would love to know. Did Paramount pay for an ad for you to tell us to go see Mission Impossible? Or was that you telling people, okay, now you can go see Mission Impossible using MoviePass? I would love to know if Paramount paid for that.
Yeah. And, you know, and the income that they report is nowhere near as $4 to $6 a month per customer in terms of money beyond the subscription. Almost everything they made was from subscription, and they were making a low six figures off of other revenue streams. So suddenly now they're making, you know, $15 million a month on ads? Really? The fact is they claim they have 3 million customers a month. That means they're grossing about $45 million a month in income.
Right, which is basically why they've tried to slow down people using the plan. Because if they could just slow it down just a bit, then they can actually start banking some of that money so that they can begin to kind of build up their coffers
again. I don't think so. Most of their customers are in big cities. And so we can assume ticket prices are a lot higher than the regular average. But say they're about $10 a month, $10 a ticket. They can afford for everyone to go to 1.5 movies a month. After that, they're starting to lose money.
Well, when you think about AMC said, we've done all the studies, and they have a plan in the United States for you get to see 3 movies a week.
And they say they'll lose money, and they'll lose money on it.
Yeah, for the first 3 months. And they say it's 20. Two quarters, they will lose money. And their hope is to get to a point where they have enough subscribers, around 2 million, to be paying for $20 a month. And they are trying to, on average, they believe that they will see 2.5 to 2.25 movies per month, at which point they will be netting $10 to $15 million per month.
Yeah, but I don't think those numbers make sense.
Well,
the 2 million people who are going to subscribe to AMC are not going to go see 2 movies a month. Why would you pay $20 if you live in the heartland to go see 2 movies a month? Nobody would do that. You can see movies on Tuesday for $5. You can, if you're in a big city, tickets are $15. So if I see 2 movies, they're losing money.
Well, but how many customers have they signed up in the first 5 weeks? 175,000, right?
Well, what does it matter? If the cost is $20 a month, you're going to lose money on every customer. We can see that with MoviePass. Millions of people want to go see a lot more movies, and they'll do it for a flat rate.
Right. Just like Netflix.
So I'm not going to pay for AMC if I go to 2 movies a month. That would be why would I spend money to you know, $8 a ticket is the ticket price. There are matinees. There are weekday prices. There's Tuesday prices. Why the heck would I spend $20 a month unless I'm going to go to more than 2 movies? Or if unless I live in a big city where the ticket price is higher. The people who will buy AMC live in New York and LA and Chicago and big cities where tickets are $12, $15 a movie, and they'll see 2 movies and you'll immediately be losing money. So their estimates are wrong. It is a money-losing proposition unless they get so many people, 10, 20 million people who don't go to the movies and for some reason get conned into spending, you know, there's no good benefit from owning a movie subscription plan the way is a gym membership. You feel good owning a gym membership. You feel like an idiot if you spend $20 a month and you never go to the movies. Well, so I don't think they're any more right than MoviePass is.
Well, I wonder how many people, you know, buy SiriusXM satellite radio here in the US or North America, or buy Spotify or even Netflix, right? And then just don't use it in a month.
Well, that's because they're up to 80 million people. Right. Worldwide, if you're talking about 2 million people subscribing to AMC and they're saying, oh, we're going to make money because they'll only go to 2.0. No. You're going to have people in big cities or people who go to lots of movies. And those people are not going to see 2 movies a month. And if they do, why the heck would they give you $20 to do it?
Yes.
You know, we're all ready to quit MoviePass when they won't let us see any movies. For a week, they wouldn't let you see anything. I'm like, well, this isn't going to last. I'm going to quit.
Yeah, well, the frustration factor with MoviePass is really what's one of their... Like I said, the biggest problem that they have is people are frustrated with them. They have no more faith in them anymore. And that...
It doesn't matter. They have nowhere else to turn.
Well, that's true.
Nowhere else to turn, so that they're fine.
And in some cases,
I don't know a single person who has quit MoviePass. Not one.
Well, I haven't quit, and here's why. You ready to hear why I haven't quit MoviePass?
Because you still make more money on it.
Well, and here's the thing. You know, you monthly people, you know, you all can go see 3 movies a month. I can still see 1 movie per day. I can still see.
Yeah, we'll see how many. We'll have to see what they block or don't block you.
Yeah, well, actually, yesterday I could have seen, you know, at one theater I could see The Meg and Mission Impossible and Mamma Mia, which was only, that, those were the only films playing at that theater, because yeah, they had
They also block movies that are playing at a theater and don't show you all the movies. I've seen that.
Yes, correct.
I've seen multiple theaters where they just list one movie playing, not even just, oh, you've seen the others. They just don't even show you that there are other movies playing there.
Right. So I've seen that as well.
That's an issue too. All right, we've killed it to death. Who cares?
Well, what I was going to
completely new information.
Right, that's the problem. Is that next week we'll have a new information. But what I was going to say is that the people who have annual plans don't get surge pricing. They don't get the ticket limit per month until their plans expire.
And then, they're not selling those anymore.
Oh God, no. They sold them in November and December through Costco. And
right. So the minority of people who bought an annual plan, they win out. I don't know why they can't change the rules on them too, but nonetheless, they're the lucky suckers who get a slightly better plan until their plan expires.
Correct.
So a percentage of a tiny minority of the people who did it, great, good for you. I'm glad.
And a lot of people would say not until their plan expires, until MoviePass goes away.
Exactly. What won't go away are remakes and reboots and sequels and spinoffs, because Hollywood loves them. Among the reboots and remakes, sequels and spinoffs mentioned, ALF. ALF, the TV series, is coming back.
We keep mentioning this. We keep mentioning ALF. I feel like we've mentioned ALF 500 times. Yes. ALF will be...
Oh, they've tricked us. They've tricked us. Well, this, you know, we used to have a rule. This is what I was going to get to. We had a rule. We won't mention this unless, I think actually the... unless it's actually greenlit. I was going to get to the end of that when it said the ALF, the Facts of Life, and a TV show based on the song Hey There Delilah by Plain White Tees. That's a TV show. They'll probably pair with Jack and Diane, the TV series based on the song by John Cougar Mellencamp.
So wait, Hey There Delilah by the Plain White Tees?
Yeah.
Okay, that's going to be a TV
Well, it's being shopped around.
Okay, well, you keep shopping.
Right. So in Facts of Life, they said, oh, we want to make this. And it doesn't make any sense. Producers on The Facts of Life, a reboot of The Facts of Life, Leonardo DiCaprio and Jessica Biel. Why would they be linked to a reboot of The Facts of Life? I mean, if he was going to be involved in a TV reboot, wouldn't it be Growing Pains?
That he was actually in. Yeah.
And yeah, he was on briefly as the, you know, cute young kid, the cute homeless kid who needed a family to take him in. Why is he involved in The Facts of Life? And the second they mention the show, Charlotte Ray dies.
Yeah, Charlotte Ray she was the kind of warden, so to speak, and I realize it wasn't a prison movie, but she was the
character. She was the housekeeper. She was the friendly, warm presence on the show, the motherly presence. She died at the age of 92, just days after the announcement of maybe a Facts of Life reboot. She played it on two different series, the same character, as also guest starred on other series. So she played that character for many years, starting with, of course, Different Strokes. But Cloris Leachman is still around, and she took over that role later in the run of the show. So, you know, Cloris Leachman's like, I'm available. But
the funny thing is that the day that Charlotte Ray died, I was actually in Peekskill, New York.
Is that where the show is based?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Well, you know more about it than I do. But there is one project that is happening, and it is a reboot of Shogun. FX announced they're going to do a remake of Shogun. And they're excited by it. And John Landgraf said, quote, if you just sort of exoticized or fetishized Japanese culture through the Western male gaze, it probably wouldn't fly. Okay, as far as I'm concerned, but they would have been smarter for him to say, that's exactly why we want to do Shogun, because that's not a criticism of Shogun. Shogun was a very groundbreaking series. It treated Japanese culture seriously. It may be dated by today's terms, but it certainly was a very, very noble effort to give historical accuracy and currency to Japanese culture from that period. One of the exciting things about the miniseries was our hero was shipwrecked on Japan, and he didn't speak any Japanese because nobody had ever been in there. If you landed there, they killed you immediately. They really were blocked off from the rest of the world. And for the TV series, they didn't use subtitles. Japanese people would yell at him, and he didn't know what they were saying, and neither did we. Because, well, we didn't, unless you spoke Japanese. And that was really exciting. It really mimicked the plight of our hero, played by Richard Chamberlain. And that went on for the entire series. As time went on, he learned some words and characters would translate for him into English. But that was pretty amazing. So that was a pretty ballsy thing to do, to have an entire series where a lot of people are speaking Japanese and you just don't translate what they're saying. They dealt with it cleverly and they made it so we weren't lost and you would learn Japanese phrases like arigato and things like that. And if there's one reason why I struggle and strive to speak the film title or say words or pronounce actors' names correctly based on their pronunciation from their language, it might be Shogun, because I loved that miniseries when I saw it as a kid. I really respected what they did. I respected how he learned to speak some of their phrases and tried to communicate with them. And even if I butcher it and don't get something right in Indian or Japanese or Mandarin or whatever it may be, I'm trying. And I think this show is one reason why. It was a really cool, intelligent miniseries. It is not exoticizing or fetishizing Japanese culture at all. So John Langreth shows a little bit of a cluelessness about what Shogun actually was and is and should be if they're going to remake it. It's ripe for remake, but he should have more respect for the property that it is.
Did you ever see the movie The 13th Warrior?
No, but is that Keanu Reeves or who was in that?
That was Antonio Banderas in a John McTiernan directed film, right. Although Michael Crichton also apparently directed part of it. He wrote the novel. And in it, it's similar. The main character lands somewhere and doesn't speak the language, and they have a very clever way of getting through that in that time passes, and they have like a montage where you can see he's picking up words and he begins to learn the language so that they clear that hurdle.
Well, and then they segue into just everybody speaking English because we now knew that he understood them and they understood him.
Exactly.
Right, so that Shogun did not do that. They continued to speak Japanese and they never use subtitles. So that's pretty cool. I mean, a 6-hour, 8-hour, or 5-night miniseries on American primetime TV with, you know, a third or half of the dialogue being in Japanese. That's pretty, you know people would stick with it and how they dealt with that. That was pretty groundbreaking. It was a hugely successful miniseries.
Yeah, let's put it this way. I remember the miniseries. Okay, Masada, oh. Shogun, oh, yeah. The Winds of
Same
War.
Same year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. These are all miniseries that I remember.
Well, they were massively, massively successful, of course. They were watched by everybody. You know, they were hugely popular events. And, you know, you would devote, you know, ages and ages to watching them, which is the exact opposite of Jeffrey Katzenberg's new platform, which is new TV, which is the idea of TV in 10-minute sound bites.
Yeah, you know what? If we were on the new TV network, you would have stopped listening and or watching us about 30 minutes ago.
It would take 20 episodes to get through one show.
That's correct.
That's right. So they raised $1 billion. It's a new concept called new TV, but that's just a placeholder of a name. The actual thing won't be called new TV. They're going to come up with some other name. And we got a little more information now that they have raised funds from investors. This is from Jeffrey Katzenberg and from Meg Whitman, who is the CEO, or I forget what her title is, but she's in charge of the puppy. Basically, we know that most of the money they raised will be spent on content. They expect to launch at the end of 2019. Their basic idea is to create content that will be consumed in 10-minute bursts, whether it's fiction like drama or comedy or sketch comedy or reality or news, whatever it is, you're probably going to want to consume it in about a 10-minute burst. And they also say producers will own their own content after the window on this platform or service ends. So if you create a show for new TV, it's not like creating a show for Netflix, where Netflix funds it and owns it. They own House of Cards. In this case, they're saying, we'll help you make your show, we'll give you some money, but you'll own it when you're done. And it's aimed... Is the demographic is aimed at the 25 to 30-year-olds?
25 to 30-year-olds.
Really?
You're breaking it. We should probably tell our audience that you are traveling and that your Wi-Fi is less than reliable.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. I keep trying. We keep quitting. We keep hanging up, calling back, rebooting. It's not helping, I guess.
But so this is aimed at 25 to 30-year-olds, and it's
what kind of demo is that? I've never heard of such a thing. Well, the 25 to 30-year-old demo? That's ridiculous.
Well, you know what? I got to tell you, my kids watch these videos, and they're only about 10 minutes long, and they love them. They will literally sit there on YouTube and watch one video after another. And
but
I think to myself,
they're not in the target audience.
No, I understand that, but they are the future of that, and so I think that basically people who are 25 to 30-year-olds. Have gotten used to watching content in that way. I think that
well, why would you
I think
such
you're
a
right. I think
demo.
Well, that's true too. Why would you have
that? That's an insanely bizarre narrow demo. That's it. That day I said, give us $1 billion. We're targeting people who are 25 to 30 because who gives a damn about the money of 24-year-olds?
Well, remember, like, the millennials is, that's a huge group of people, and that squarely fits into the millennial category.
That's less than the millennial category. This is what I don't understand. It's not a typical span. It's not a generation. It's not whatever. It's just ridiculous. It's not the 18 to 34. It's the 25 to 30 demo. That's insane. That to me indicates a cluelessness, which this whole thing seems clueless to me. I don't get it. Now they say it's going to be a subscription service. The low tier will be free, but you'll have to watch ads. The upper tier, they'll have no ads.
Okay.
So you pay, but you're going to see ads. Okay. All right. Their competition, as they see it, is cheaply produced, user-generated fare on YouTube and Facebook. That's who they see as their competition. So they say, all right, you're commuting, and you're going to watch something on your phone, and they think their competition is only cheaply produced, user-generated fare on YouTube and Facebook. Music videos, sketch comedy from late night, TV shows, which only run 22 minutes. Netflix has 50-minute stand-up shows. Sitcoms, again, are 22 minutes.
How about this?
People, all the things I watch people watching on their phone, traveling on the subway, that's the stuff they're watching. And it is not cheaply produced, user-generated fare. There's a lot of demand for this stuff, but there's a lot of highly produced, well-known fare already out there that people are watching and consuming.
Yeah, I think, well, look, I'm sure that this idea and concept will change over time, but I think that, you know, certainly short form content has, there is some validity to it, how you go about marketing it and making it and serving it up. I don't know whether $1 billion would, I don't know.
They said it's just enough to get going. They really wanted 2 billion, but we can launch with 1 billion, which is nice to know.
Yeah.
And again, Mark Burnett, who's a smart guy, made a lot of money with Survivor, et cetera. He said, this idea is amazing. It's amazing, he said. It's amazing. As if it's not already being done every minute of the day. And the person in charge of all this content is Meg Whitman, who knows virtually nothing about content.
Well, she worked at PayPal. Yes, and she just PayPal. Left Hewlett Packard.
Right. PayPal and Hewlett, but she worked briefly at Disney. She is not a content person. So why is she the person? Meg Whitman said, quote, really, this allows us to launch our vision of bringing together the best of Hollywood and Silicon Valley. And again, that makes it sound like there's something new they need to do to bring together Silicon Valley and Hollywood. I mean, people already have smartphones and they have tablets, so I'm not quite sure what they think needs to be done in terms of technology. I just don't understand why somebody who's in tech is being brought in to oversee content.
Well, why don't we move on to talk about from one form of media to another, which is music.
All right. Well, yeah. So this is a story about the music industry as a whole. What is the story? They're saying spending is up, spending is down. What's happening?
Well, U.S. listeners, they are spending more money on music than ever before, over $20 billion a year. Okay, that seems like a lot of money. This is a new report from Citigroup. Total music revenue, and this includes from on-demand and CD sales and radio play and live events. There's advertising as well, by the way, so there's licensing for advertising. It has risen to about $43 billion a year. Now, of that, okay, so you have $43 billion a year, artists take home about 12%, $5 billion.
Right. And so they were painting that as really amazingly low. That's what one of the co-authors told Rolling Stone.
Yeah, this is a great Rolling Stone article that I was going to try and get the author on for, but did not have time. But it's an interesting article in Rolling Stone that is worth reading.
Well, I have a few problems with the article, though. If you look closely, one of the pieces of information is that back in 2000, artists only captured 7% of total revenue. So I'm not sure what the graph is over long term. I'd love to know, but at least the details that they gave me, in 2000, they only got 7%. Now they're getting 12%. Well, that sounds like a big jump. That's almost a 100% increase in the amount of revenue captured by artists. So that sounds like a good story to tell, not a bad story. And I'd also love to see total revenue or total money spent on music tracked over the years. They're just giving us this one piece of information, and it's hard to judge it because we don't have the context. So for me, it was not a very good Citigroup report. Well, the only info they told me was that artists are getting a lot more today than they were 18 years ago. And they're saying, isn't this horrible? Also, how does that compare to other businesses? So there's not enough information for me to judge this report or the status of artists and music in general. And I don't have enough information about Aretha Franklin, but there is a report that she's seriously ill. So that's sad news. And you know, why wait till she dies? Go check out her great albums like I Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You or Lady Soul. Do it right now while she's alive, because what could be a better way to celebrate her, give her some good vibes, than to check out some of the best soul music of all time?
Well, now, wasn't she she's been gravely ill before, and she's had cancer, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, she had to cancel her tour just a few months ago, so she's home. She's not doing well.
Well, you know, I hope she recovers, I hope she recovers.
Of course.
Now, let me ask you this, Michael. Are there any books about Aretha Franklin? And if so,
of course,
were they ever a pick on bookfilter.com? And Bookfilter is where you go to find out what you should be reading each week, because every week, out of the hundreds of thousands of books that are published each year, the tens of thousands that are published each week, you tell us the books we should be reading on bookfilter.com. But here on the show, you bring one or two that are kind of ready for their close-up that might be good for adaptations or maybe even turned into a TV series. What have you got for us this week?
Well, I don't have an Aretha Franklin book, but she's a strong woman. If you're going to succeed in the music industry, you have to be a strong person in order to get to the top and stay there for decades the way she has. But there is a strong female character in the new book I'm reading called The Sea Queen by Linnea Hartsiker. This is book two of a trilogy. I also touted her first book, The Half-Drowned King. This is set back more than a millennium ago. It's set in Norway, and it's a trilogy of books, and it's kind of Games of Thrones meets Wolf Hall. Who doesn't want to mention Games of Thrones when making a pitch these days? But it has great characters, sea battles, lust, betrayal, women kicking ass. It's a really great property. The first book was great. The second book holds up just as well. It starts 6 years later. It could easily be a TV series, but there's so much of it takes place on water that gets expensive. So it might have to be a trilogy of films, and you'd really want to make them all at once because it's one long story. But The Sea Queen by Linnea Hartsiker, terrific book.
Okay, well, these days you probably don't even need a book to make a movie. You could just base it on and I say this kind of jokingly, because of course Listen, who's the they? Hollywood has always turned magazine articles into movies.
Like the Monopoly story, right?
Wait, the Monopoly story? What are you talking about?
Oh, didn't you read about this? Oh, there was a big story in the Daily Beast about a scam involving the McDonald's Monopoly game.
Oh, yes. I thought you meant the board game, which it kind of is. But yes, I know what you're talking about.
And Matt Damon and Ben Affleck paid $1 million for the rights to that article involving the McDonald's Monopoly game sweepstakes. It was a big scam that an insider was pulling off, handing out tokens to other people, holding off the big lottery prize for himself. So Affleck will be directing, Matt Damon will be starring. It was funny that happened this week, because I had already seen two other stories that I thought, oh my God, this has to be a movie too. One was a story about two criminals stealing the Swedish crown jewels from the Strongness Cathedral, and then they jumped into a waiting speedboat to make their getaway. I mean, it sounds like a James Bond film. They went into the cathedral, grabbed the jewels, jumped in a speedboat, and then the cops started chasing them with helicopters and speedboats. They were right on them, and then their speedboat just disappeared. they got two crowns and a royal orb. I mean, I don't know what happened there, but I mean, Sweden's priceless royal crown jewels stolen in broad daylight. Thieves chased by police on motorboats. It sounds like a film to me. And then another story, this one from China, our friends in the Middle Kingdom. An acclaimed Chinese crime novelist was arrested for a 22-year-old murder, a murder that happened decades ago. When the cops showed up, he said, quote, "I've been waiting for you all this time," end quote. And he admits that details in his crime novels were inspired by the brutal killing of a couple and their grandson at a hostel they owned, the very crime for which he is accused of murder. I mean, a famous crime novelist who turns out to have committed murder decades ago, that's kind of crazy.
I feel like that's been a Hitchcock movie or has been made into a movie already. I don't know.
Probably. You're right.
That said, you know, one of the more recent articles turned into a film was The Suspects Wore Louis Vuitton, which was turned into, and that was a Vanity Fair article, that was turned into The Bling Ring.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm sure there will be countless movies and books and nonfiction works about the Me Too era and the sexual misconduct palooza that we're facing in Hollywood right now. And certainly the stuff at CBS has been heating up ever since you've been on break.
Yes, Les Moonves, he actually during our last episode, you said, oh, he's going to lose his job. And I would have agreed with you. I thought for sure that was it. He was done. He's 68 years old.
He will. He will lose his job.
Yeah, the board just can't. But they stuck by him for now.
No, they didn't stick by him. They have hired two law firms and set up a special committee to oversee an investigation. You can't just, legally, I don't think you can just fire somebody willy-nilly at that level without making damn sure you cover your tracks and do a thorough investigation so that you're not exposing yourself to lawsuit or, all sorts of things. It's going to be hard to untangle this. He's the head of the company. But they have hired two law firms. They have rolled it into one long investigation involving both Les Moonves and Charlie Rose and CBS News. The head of CBS 60 Minutes, that TV show, he is staying on vacation. He and his family were on vacation. He said, you know what? I'm having a great time. I think I'll just stay away for a while because they are seriously caught up in all of this. Sherry Redstone's company has filed accusations saying CBS is covering up and destroying evidence by using messaging apps that automatically erase text messages. They apparently approached the board with issues and concerns that they wanted addressed before this all came to light. So there is a lot. The USC School of Cinematic Arts, they're suspending Moonves from the board during this investigation. Names have been removed from buildings. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's just a mess, to be honest. The whole thing is a mess.
And of course, while CBS is accused of having this pattern of sexual harassment and an unhealthy work atmosphere, they are picking up Love Island, the bottom feeding reality dating show from the UK, where they send a group of people to a tropical location and you have to pair up with someone or you're going to be eliminated. People have sex on the show. There's all sorts of things going on, but it is the hottest reality show in the UK right now, setting records for ITV2. It's been nonstop fodder for the tabloids and the trades and People magazine type stuff in the UK. And that is coming to CBS and America. You knew someone would pick it up, and CBS is doing, boy, not the best of times.
Well, and over at Amazon, they still are having issues. They had issues with Roy Price, and he's mm-hmm. out. And then they have a new head, Jennifer Salk, who came in as the head of Amazon Studios. And now, the person who took over for Conrad Riggs after Salk came on board is out as well, Heather Schuster.
And she was in charge of unscripted TV for Amazon, right?
Yes.
So not a big play area for them yet. They have some stuff going on, but it's not a huge area for them. But yes, she is out as well. They found evidence, they say, of verbal abuse. That's what they publicly charged her with and said that that's why she was being fired. But there is some good news.
Let me tell you something about Hollywood, okay? If verbal abuse, do you know how many lawsuits I could have been involved in if verbal abuse was,
but that's exactly what should end. When you can treat people like dirt, you will also treat them like sexual objects. There's no reason why you should work for Joel Silver and have crap thrown at you. That's unacceptable. You should not have a director on iHeart Huckabee's abusing people. It's not just sexual assault and harassment and, demands of sex in exchange for work. When you let people treat other people like dirt and not behave decently and humanely, that's going to lead to sexual misconduct, inevitably.
Well, at least there is some good news. HBO has good news. They always seem to have good news over at HBO, for the most part.
Except when their boss tells them to pick it up. Yeah, you slackers.
Yeah.
That's right.
You only have 20 hit television shows. We want 25.
Or more like 50.
Yeah, I was going to say, as a matter of fact, make it 100. Make it an even 100. Let's round up.
So yeah, they had some diversity figures to report, and it's good news. They say in the 2017-2018 season, most of the directors were women or people of color. 57%, almost 60% of all directors, listing every director, whether you directed one episode or 15 episodes. So I want to keep that context clear, but still, it's a big improvement. They say it's more than double the number from 3 years ago. They expect next year to be even better. So this is not a short-term blip. And they say, as pointing to that, they say 6 of 11 pilots that were shot for 2018 have been directed by women. So that's, you know, 43% of writers have been women or people of color. They expect that to be 50% next year. FX had some similarly good news. They say 52% of their writers, 72% of their actors, their series regulars, and 49% of directors are women or people of color. So as far as I'm concerned, these are single figures from single years, but they're trending in the right direction, and I think it's a big deal.
Oh, wait a second. You said big deal, and you always do that. You always hand it off to me perfectly for us to move into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the mega merger of TV station powerhouses Sinclair and Tribune is dead. The combined company would have reached two-thirds of all households in the U.S., making a mockery of antitrust laws. Gee, how do we feel about this? still, it was assumed the pro-Trump Sinclair would get approval and continue pushing propaganda to local stations around the country. Tribune called off the $3.9 billion deal and immediately sued Sinclair for failing in its duty to take responsible, or reasonable, I should say, steps to ensure the merger took place. Instead, they argue Sinclair tried to pull a fast one with sidecar deals that meant it would meet approval by selling off some stations but retain control and ultimately buy them back. Sinclair also reportedly was fixing ad rates before the deal went through, inspiring lawsuits from others. Big deal or big whoop?
This is fascinating. It's a very big deal, but this merger is not going to happen. We'll have to see what happens to the Tribune stations now. But Sinclair, you know, they're basically being accused of hubris. They did everything they possibly could wrong. They antagonized and threatened government officials at the DOJ and the FCC. They simply refused to sell the stations that they said, look, these are the stations in these 10 markets that are problematic. They refused to do it. They threatened to sue again. They attacked the guy overseeing this with an in-your-face letter. Tribune thought of suing way back in February because they felt like Sinclair was doing such a ridiculous job in, you know, in kneecapping the merger that they wanted to happen. Nonetheless, it could help Fox News, which is, of course, another Trump supporter. So if you're wondering why this happened, if you want to get conspiracy theory, this helps Fox News because they were going to face a competitor since Sinclair was planning to launch a rival station competing with Fox News via WGN. So I don't think there's any reason to think that. It looks like Sinclair just messed it up all on their own. If they'd played by the book, they probably would have had all these stations by now.
Movies make money. Okay, next story. No, movies make money long after they've stopped playing at your local multiplex. And the same goes for Broadway shows. Oh, I love this time of year where we always have this new list. Broadway shows, they've got touring in the U.S. and around the world. So all those shows we talked about, Hello Dolly might not tour, but...
Oh, it's touring. Betty Buckley is touring around the U.S. with it. Absolutely.
Ooh, that should be good, actually. Certainly, Harry Potter is already, they're opening in San Francisco. There's a couple being planned right now. But certainly, these Broadway productions, they tour around the world. They have sit-down productions in the West End and other major world cities. And sometimes they come to off-Broadway and movie versions and screenings of the stage show itself get put into movie theaters or on PBS or television. And that's not all. Then people start paying to produce your play or musical for community theater and schools. And thus, we come to this year's list of the most produced plays and musicals in high schools around the United States for the 2017-2018 season. A new musical is on top, with Beauty and the Beast ending the three-year reign of the Addams Family.
Thank God.
And one year after breaking into the top 10 of plays, Peter and the Starcatcher has leapt to number three, just behind Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. By the way, he's really pissed he's not getting royalties on that. And Almost Maine, a perennial favorite unknown outside the world of student theater. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's fun to see these lists and what's happening. I just saw a factoid about Disney musicals saying that like 38% of all Americans have either gone to see a Disney musical or participated in it in one way, shape, or form. I mean, that's almost half the population. Like 40% of the population has literally participated in one of a Disney. That's how stitched into the fabric of society there. It's right up there with Rodgers and Hammerstein. So Beauty and the Beast is back on top. I'm happy because the Addams Family is a very poor musical. There's been good durability for Shrek and Seussical. Usually you'll find plays like 12 Angry Jurors, the new version of 12 Angry Men so that women can act in it too, or Our Town. Those are perennial favorites. So seeing Peter and the Starcatcher leap into the top 10 and now number 3 is really exciting. Musicals, not great representation of women for creators, and same problem with plays. There's one female playwright listed. Her name is D.W. Gregory, and her 2003 play Radium Girls, which is about women working in a watch factory who fall ill from radiation. It's sort of a social consciousness-raising play. That is a very popular play. She writes plays like that, designed for kids, and she's had a fair amount of success doing that. So there's a whole market there, like Almost Maine, that collection of one acts that we talked about, and now this play, Radium Girls, that have a lot of success. Level never seen on Broadway, but it's fun stuff and kids are doing it all over the country.
You know, they should bring Radium Girls to Broadway. I bet it would kill at the box office.
Nice.
Star Trek 4. Wait, didn't we have a Star Trek 4 already? Well, it's looking to boldly go where no franchise film has gone before, with lower salaries. Paramount wants Chris Pine and Chris Hemsworth aboard for Star Trek 4, with Pine playing Captain James T. Kirk and Hemsworth playing his dad, a role the actor tackled in the prologue to the series reboot in 2009. A time travel plot will have them side by side in the new movie, but Paramount would like to do it on a dime. Star Trek movies just don't make that much money, they say. Pine says, we've already got a deal in place, and Hemsworth insists carrying that hammer around is murder on his back. And have you seen his chiropractor bills? Good grief. At the moment, talks are at an impasse. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I've no doubt that this was leaked by the studio, that they're the ones who wanted this information to get out and just put it on the actors and say they're the ones to blame if this isn't working right now. But frankly, I think the actors look like idiots.
Really?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the budgets for these movies, you know, Star Trek Into Darkness cost $190 million to make. It grossed $470 million. The last one cost $185 million to make. It didn't even double that at the box office. It made $336 million. That's not even double the cost of the movie.
You see, I would have said, and I know what you're saying. You're basically saying, look, these films don't make a lot of money. Okay.
Right. And they're good movies for you, and they're better than most of other things, and they get your name out there. And like, what, 10 million isn't enough? More than 20 million? I don't know the numbers on the table, but Chris Pine and Chris Hemsworth are not big stars outside these projects that are bigger than them. Someone else will play Thor, and someone else will play Captain Kirk in the future. So be happy you're involved in it. Maybe this isn't the biggest payday for you anymore. Maybe it is still, but you know, and he's got Wonder Woman. You know, it's silly not to want to make another Star Trek movie happen. They can't make a deal where they say, all right, give me $8 million, and then if it hits $500 million or $750 million worldwide, I get an extra bump of money.
Wait a second. I don't think, spoiler alert here. So close your ears if you haven't seen Wonder Woman, but didn't he die at the end of Wonder Woman?
He's back in the new one because it's set in the 1980s. So he's presumably the son or grandson of the guy from the first movie.
Okay. All right. Jeez Louise. Okay. You know, I was going to say that it was leaked by the actors who are trying to say, look, Paramount's in trouble. They can barely make a movie. And, you know, they just don't have the budget to be paying us.
But they paid $190 million to make the last two movies each.
Right.
That's big budget movie. So they want a big budget movie, but they're like, look, they're not making much money. So maybe if we could get it down to 130, we could actually have a successful series that would continue.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, I'm sure not asking them to take $50 and, you know, free lunch. And surely they could say, all right, I'll take $8 million. And then if the movie hits $700 million, I get more, right? None of them have even hit $500 million. So they're not even close to big budget movies. You know, they're getting big budgets and they're not delivering. And clearly they're making some money on them or they wouldn't keep making them. I recognize that. But out of the box, at the theater, these movies are costing a lot more than they're grossing. And it's reasonable for the studio to want to rein it in. And I think the value of the franchise to the actors is more than the other way around. Shouldn't get screwed. Just become, take part of the risk yourself. Say, all right, but if it makes $700 million, I want an extra $5 million. Right? What's wrong with that?
Yeah, because that always works.
Well, it is if you do it by gross box office. You don't have to, it's not net.
Yeah, well, you'd have to, and there are deals like that. The bonuses are based on national box office, yeah. And right, now international, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Apparently, Netflix liked what it saw when they bought the movie Mowgli. Now, the streaming service is getting into the Andy Serkis business. They've put all those little dots all over everybody that works there. They've signed the director of that film to make a new adaptation of George Orwell's Animal Farm, a story destined to be filmed with motion capture technology, which I was just referring to with those little dots. So, Serkis will just be directing. Apparently, playing the ape Caesar means tackling the pig Napoleon. Napoleon would be old hat, big dealer, big whoop.
Well, it's a big whoop. Director gets job, as our old friend Karen Woodward would say. But it's a reasonable project. It makes sense for him. If he did a good job on Mowgli as a director, why not have him tackle it? And frankly, I love Animal Farm a lot more than 1984. So I'm interested to see what they do with it.
Travis Scott has dethroned Drake's new album, Scorpion, after 5 weeks at number one on the Billboard 200. Scott's Astroworld enjoyed the second biggest debut of 2018 and marks his second number one album, but overseas, a champ continues to reign. The new hits compilation, Now That's What I Call Music, number 67, is number one on the UK charts. It's the fastest-selling album of 2018 in terms of actual copies for that market, and the series has held onto the number one slot in the compilations chart for 655 weeks. That's 35 wow. years and counting, with some 120 million copies sold worldwide for the franchise. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I mean, it just shows the power of that. But I think I got the name of the album wrong. I mean, look at all those money. You would think that album sales would not work for that, because these are collections of new singles. Right. So you would think that would appeal to young people, not to the older people who typically buy albums. Older people will buy the new Adele album, but you wouldn't think they'd be staying on top of the hop hit new singles. So I'm a little surprised that, in fact, that's what's happening here, that it still has currency. I mean, I have streamed Now That's What I Call Music at times on streaming services, but buying them, you would think that just doesn't make any sense. You wouldn't think there'd be a market for it. So I'm intrigued by the fact that it's happening. It's cool. It's the fastest selling album of 2018 in terms of actual copies. Good Lord. That's kind of amazing.
The major TV network signed a new 8-year deal to broadcast the Emmy Awards. "We can't win the Emmys," said a spokesperson for the networks, "but we sure can as hell host all of them." ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox will fork over about $10 million a year, and each will foot the bill, essentially, for putting on the show. No word yet on whether they got permission to push even more awards off the actual broadcast. We'll talk about that a little later. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It makes sense, though, frankly. When you think about it, maybe Netflix and HBO should be hosting the Emmy Awards. They're the ones who win them all.
Lady Gaga continues to barrel through an entire pop star's career at breakneck speed. Pretty soon she'll be playing casinos. Oh, actually, wait, she is. She became a world-beating superstar with her debut album, The Fame. She got all David Bowie by sporting outrageous fashions created by upcoming designers. She dove right into a disappointing follow-up and an ignored third album, appearing to be increasingly irrelevant. But wait, she went Broadway by singing a medley of songs from The Sound of Music at the Oscars. She took that late career turn into jazz by recording a duets album with Tony Bennett, turned to movies a la Barbara Streisand, and now to top it off, she's going to Vegas. Yes, Lady Gaga is doing a residency starting in December and lasting most of 2019 with about 2 shows a month and time off for the Oscars, we assume. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess at this stage it's a big whoop. These residencies are not embarrassing anymore. It used to be you did it when you were, career was over, like, well, I'll go to Vegas. But now, Springsteen sets up a residency on Broadway. Country Acts set up residency at Branson, Missouri. Lady Gaga's in Vegas. It just says, hey, I'll let you come to me. It's an easier way to do it than traveling the world.
Yeah, well, and even the Rolling Stones thought of doing it when they said, look, Keith can't travel anymore. So maybe, he can, but it's better if he doesn't. So maybe we take up residency at the O2 Arena or the Staples Center or Madison Square Garden.
Or like the Billy Joel at Madison Square Garden, right? One show a month. Yeah, it's like that's what Springsteen has done on Broadway, isn't it? I mean, he could have just done this concert on Broadway every night. It didn't have to be a show like he did. He could just set up there and do a show. People would be thrilled. They'd come forever.
That's right. And they'd probably come more than once if they could.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, that your reference to her starring in A Star Is Born, basically. Mm-hmm. Apparently, the film is quite good.
You saw it?
I've seen about 15 minutes of it, the opening 15 minutes, and it was pretty good. And I know that the studio really, really is backing it. They think they have a huge hit on their hands.
All right.
Now, Bring Out Your Dead. Bring Out Your Dead. Do you know what movie that's from, by the way?
Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Yes. No, we're not facing a new plague, which is what that references. We're just seeing the continued decline of print media. The latest casualty is at Condé Nast, where the publisher is looking for buyers for the titles Brides, Golf Digest, and W. Maybe it's no surprise when you look where growth is happening. TV's Don Osteroff is in charge of video for Condé Nast, and for the first time in history, web and video revenue surpassed print this year. In a way, the company now makes videos with ads and print.
In a way, the company now makes videos with ads while print is secondary.
Okay. In a way, the company now makes videos with ads while print is secondary. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think they're jumping the gun a little bit. They say web and video revenue. Well, how much is web revenue? And web revenue is there because people want to read W and Brides and Golf Digest. And they're just doing it online rather than buying a physical issue. But it's still the magazine. You know, it's not necessarily the video. So I'd like to know exactly the breakdown of web versus video. But it is a major step forward that they're making more money digitally than they are in print. But I'm shocked mostly by Brides.
Yeah, I mean, shocked. Come on. Talk about a perennial. I mean, that is at every newsstand. And I thought it was selling well. I right, see it all the time.
And it's thick as a phone book. You know, those bridal magazines are thick as phone books. So that's a little shocking to me. That's for sure.
If I threw the latest issue of Brides magazine at you, I could be arrested for attempted murder.
I would sue you.
Right, exactly. Now, Warner Music Group has sold off their stake in the streaming service Spotify. That netted the company some $500 million in all, and a lot of it, or rather some of it, is being handed out to artists and distributed labels. And then some of that is being handed right back. When Sony decided to hand out some of its proceeds from a stake in Spotify, they didn't take into account any in-house debt, like monies owed for recording an album or publicity and other expenses. For instance, you know, every music video that's made, if it's not financed by the artist, it is financed by the artist. Warner Music said, we're not going to do that. We're going to basically take back all the money you owe us. They will dole out $126 million, but they will also take into account any debt on the books. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. They're doing it. They get to make the rules. It's not in people's contracts. They have no legal obligation to do so. And unless and until they do, you know, the artists are at their mercy. So it's they're not being friends to anybody here.
Yeah. I mean, when you make a music video and the record label pays for it, it comes out of your record sales. So you, as the artist, are paying for your own music video.
Right, and everything, you pay for everything. You pay for recording the album. You can be indentured for life based on the right. cost of recording an album and all the videos. But I don't understand. I'm sure record labels want to have a cut in publishing. They want to have an investment in other areas that linked to their business. Why would they not want to have an investment in Spotify? What are they telling us by dumping the shares?
I think that they're trying to say that they're not going to benefit long term off of it, that this was their way of cashing in. And, mm-hmm. you know, they cut the original deal. This was part of the money for the original deal. And they're not going to take sweetheart deals moving forward, sweetheart licensing deals moving forward, because they are part owner. That's and they're trying to separate church and state is what I'm saying.
Okay.
But that gets really kind of, that's into the weeds, which we do get sometimes, by the way, when we talk about inside baseball. In fact, it is time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Here's how this week's story can affect you. A shorter Oscars. Instead of three or four days, it'll be 3 or 4 hours. The Academy Awards is one of the most prestigious awards in the arts. Winning an Oscar will be the first thing mentioned in your obituary. It will? Wait, not yeah. Ryan. Okay. Well, it even becomes a part of your name, as in Oscar winner Michael Giltz.
What? Oh, I'd like to thank my agent. I'd like to thank... Oh.
Yeah, that was just kind of throwing that in there to, just, as an example.
Yeah, that's, I got it.
Yeah. In a bid to trash that legacy and make the Oscars more like the People's Choice Awards or the MTV Movie Awards, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences... and ABC, announced the boneheaded idea of adding a new category, because we don't have enough categories to hand out that night. Popular film. Best achievement in popular film. Clearly, they've given up on expanding the Best Picture nominees with an eye towards including top-grossing films like The Dark Knight and Spider-Man, so they're just going to give popcorn films their own category and hope that convinces people to start watching the Oscars again. They also promised to keep the show to 3 hours, dump some technical awards during the commercial breaks, and move up the 2020 awards to early February. This announcement could not have been more of a disaster and poorly handled, in my opinion.
Well, they claimed that they had a meeting and that they were worried about leaks, so they felt the need to just put out a press release and put everything on the table. But that's ridiculous. If you're just discussing an idea, there's no reason to announce it as a done deal, you know, or even, if it leaks out, you say, well, we discussed it, but nothing's been done or set in stone. We're just, we discussed lots of possibilities. And that would be your response if it leaked out. But so to say, well, we had to make the announcement because it might have leaked out is ridiculous.
And here's really who would have leaked it out. Here's who would have all the board members, the Academy board members who mm-hmm. were in charge of the sound divisions and the makeup, basically all the people that would have been shunted off to or are right now planned to be shunted off to the commercial breaks where they kind of come back and they just cut to 5.5 seconds of your speech. That's where those are the people who would have leaked it.
Well, it doesn't matter if something is mentioned, it doesn't mean it's happening.
Right.
We've discussed everything's on the table. There was no reason to say we're going to add a category for popular film. We don't know what it means. We don't know how it'll work. We don't know what it'll do. We don't know anything about it, but it's going to happen. That was ridiculous. They should not have done that. It was absurd. The whole thing was bungled. That's the big story here, not the details of what they're thinking of doing.
Well, we don't even know what they're thinking of doing.
We do. They're adding a category for popular film. They've guaranteed.
What does that mean?
They don't know.
Well, right, exactly.
But everybody, it doesn't matter. The popular film thing will not happen. They will not shunt aside editor and cinematographer to the commercial break. They may do the short films. Those make sense. Putting, the short film, live action, animated, and documentary short to the commercial breaks, that makes sense. That saves you, what, maybe 8 minutes, something like that?
Right.
So I think that's fine. That's the only category. The way they did this, by again saying we might put some technical categories there, but we don't know which ones, as you say, that has united everyone. If they said we're going to do makeup, maybe everybody else would have, moved away from makeup and said, oh, they got makeup. They would have all turned on makeup because they'd already have the red dot on their forehead. But since everybody thinks it could be them, they are all united and saying, how dare you? You're not going to do that to any of us. So they're not going to do that. There aren't that many awards. There's no reason, it doesn't matter. Nobody cares if the show hour is 3 hours and 10 minutes or 3 hours and 50 minutes. Nobody is going to turn into the Oscars because there's a category where Black Panther is competing with Bumblebee and Mission Impossible to see which is the popular film of the year. Nobody is going to watch the show because of that category. The only people who are watching and will care are the people who already watch and care. So it's just so stupid on every level. Rarely have they done something so completely derided by everybody.
Yeah, I mean everybody. They have united Hollywood.
Yes, the popular film thing will not happen. Other than the short films, I don't think it'll happen. Certainly not this year. ABC is to blame.
Yes, I would agree.
ABC is to blame. They told them, look, they kept hitting the all red alert button. Like, your show's collapsing. Ratings are collapsing. Yes, other shows are lowering too, but your show is falling faster, even though you're still number one. Young people aren't tuning in at all. You've got to do something. You've got to do something. You've got to have an award for Mission Impossible and Black Panther, or nobody's ever going to watch the Oscars again. It was ridiculous. ABC doesn't know what they're doing.
Yeah, well, that does not shock me at all. Not about ABC. I definitely could see people panicking here. They're saying, look, we're paying $75 million a year to broadcast the Oscars. And as far as the Academy goes, $75 million is a bulk of their, you know, that's some of their biggest revenue every year. And we need to keep it at that level. And you know what? Having fewer people tune in doesn't do that. So how do we
It's also ABC's number one special event. They don't have anything else. They have no NFL. They have nothing. It's their only big event. So that's the added pressure on them. But it's still like the number one. It's the biggest award show in the country. More people watch than anything else. And you know what? Every 3 or 4 years, a big popular film wins. You know, hasn't been that long since Lord of the Rings or Titanic or, you know, all the big winners in history. It's not the Academy's fault that, you know, movie studios are not making big popular films that are good enough to win the Oscar, you know?
No. Lord of the Rings, Titanic, yeah. All before the preferential ballot.
Yes. Well, they're trying to, that wasn't an attempt to block them. That was an attempt to help them.
Right. And it doesn't work. And they should get rid of the preferential ballot.
No, you're claiming that there would be movies that should have won or fat popular movies. I don't think Avengers Age of Ultron or Black Panther should win Best Picture. I don't think they're good enough.
Oh, I'm not saying no. I'm not saying.
Doesn't matter what balloting system you use. Hollywood does not make big popular films that are Best Picture type winners anymore. They just don't do it. I would have been happy to see, I don't like Dark Knight, but that would have been fine, or Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire, but they're just not they're usually not making those movies. The indie films are where the action is. So you have to embrace what you are. An Academy is an award for excellence, period. It is not an award for being popular. So you cannot fix it.
It's an award that helps you become popular.
Exactly. It really helped the movies that won. I couldn't even remember last year. I had to look it up, but it was, of course, The Shape of Water. But, you know, of the 10 movies on the list, most of them were profitable. Most of them were not, you know, $300-$500 million, but they made money based on their budget. They were successes. They were helped by the Oscars. Certainly Moonlight was. I think The Shape of Water was. Certainly Dunkirk and Get Out were big popular films. Dunkirk was, you know, by Christopher Nolan, the director, the reason that they changed the Oscars, because Dark Knight got, as they say, shunted aside. And Get Out, a big popular horror flick that was on the list of the best films of the year. That can only help the Oscars. Maybe if they made more emphasis on the fact that they've got 10 great films and said, oh, these are the best films of the year, and celebrated all of them equally, rather than, make that the celebration rather than the competition in the horse race, maybe that would help them a little bit.
Well, what do you think of the awards moving up to 2020 to early February?
Well, that's fine. They're just trying to not feel like an also-ran in afterwards, but it just means everybody else will jump up ahead of them. Everybody will just keep leapfrogging around, and then you're going to have to move again because of the Olympics or whatever. I don't care. It doesn't have to be the same week every year. You know, move whatever makes sense in the schedule, just move it up or further, you know, whatever you can do to make sure as many people can watch it as possible.
Yeah, I mean, the domino effect, you're right. The domino effect this has on the Golden Globes and on the National Board of Review. Who cares about the National Board of Review necessarily, but all of the Critics Awards, all of the awards, SAG and all, just all of the awards is the issue. Not only that, but playing longer in theaters, these films being allowed to play through February, it actually shortens the amount of time that they can earn money.
They would just be opening up in October instead of December. That's all.
Okay.
It would just affect the release schedule, you know? So, that 6 week window when they've been nominated, but haven't lost yet is very valuable.
Right. Exactly. Instead it would be like, you're nominated. Now you better, you know, walk the red carpet because it's next week.
Yeah. And the 3 hour thing is unimportant. You want to make a tighter, better, and more entertaining show? Cut out all the crap. Cut out the skits where you're like, oh, look, we've gone to a movie theater and looked at actual moviegoers. We love you. Look, we brought moviegoers to us. Look at us. We're movie stars. We love you. They have half an hour easy of junk that you do not need. The host of the show should not be creating sketch comedy material to fill. You don't need half an hour of filler. It's already long enough. It'll be entertaining, use clips from the movies, and ditch the comedy. A quick quip is all you need. Carson made one-liners and then you moved on. You need humor. He's there to segue. That's it. You do a 5-minute intro. You're there to keep it light and moving, and you're done.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. You don't need a 10 or 15 minute break to go into a movie theater and try and make something funny. However, when you're transitioning from one award to another or one piece to another, sure, the joke, you know, whoever the comedian is telling a joke here or there. Okay, great. That takes like 30 to seconds to 60 seconds and you've moved on and you've done it in a kind of memorable, funny way.
Right. You can't fix a show by destroying it. You know, you can't fix the ratings by pretending the Oscars is the People's Choice Awards. It won't help. It will only damage the brand. All you can do is embrace what you are, do the best possible show. If you're looking at stuff to switch, maybe the shorts can be shunted to the, I have no problem with that, and ditch this comedy. Ditch, you're not a variety show, you're an award show. You know, make the most of it. Since you can't have people perform all night long like the Grammys, why not show longer clips that actually introduce the movies to the people so they go, wow, I want to see that movie? Because the fact is, you can watch the Oscars and have no idea what 8 of the 10 films are about. That happens every year. You have no clue what they're about. That's how poorly a job they do of promoting and celebrating these movies. They do a terrible job. They don't show enough clips. They have too much filler. They can make a better show, but adding in a stupid category like that is not the way to go. One person said, hey, why not add in best stunts? That's an actual craft. It's a skill, and it celebrates the type of movies you're talking about. No one is going to turn into the show to see who wins best stunts, but in celebrating stunts, you are celebrating the talented people who make movies happen, and you can have some fun clips, which are easier to get across than sound mixing.
Yes, that is true.
And you know what? Another person said, you sort of destroyed the Oscars when they shunted the celebration of lifetime achievement to a separate special. Instead of having that 10, 15 minute scene where you're celebrating one of the great actors or directors or producers of all time, you know, you've lost that sense of legacy.
Yeah, now it's in the Governor's Awards.
Yeah, so, you know, there's lots of different ways they've messed with the show. They'll keep changing. I'm not opposed to changes, but, you know, boy, oh boy, did they butcher this in every possible way.
Well, that, you know, we said, look, we could either talk about the announcement by AMPAS for 10 seconds or 10 minutes. and I guess we said 10 minutes now. So why don't we move on to our obituary section and talk about people who have passed on, including Roland Perkins, who was, he helped found Creative Artists Agency, CAA, one of the largest talent agencies in the world, my former employer back in the 90s. And I guess he died at the age of 84. He was a pioneer of the TV movie.
Yeah, I mean, I figured you would have more connection to this than me, for sure, because I've never heard of him. Well, he was gone long before you showed up. Yeah,
yeah, I never worked with him. Certainly, you know, he's known for his pioneering work in motion pictures for television.
Yeah, so he helped launch TV, the idea of a TV movie. I mean, they had live television, obviously, but I guess he packaged the idea of, you know, glossy big movies with, you know, big production values and helped make that become a reality or some, you know, in some way, shape, or form. So that's cool. And another person who died this week is the writer V.S. Naipaul, the Nobel Prize winner. He died at 87. He also won the Booker, because just a few weeks ago, I read his book, In a Free State, which was nominated for the most recent Booker of Bookers. So it was nice to be able to read his book right before he died. And he certainly has a certain problematic history with people in the Caribbean and Africa. Some people have issues with how he portrays those people. But he is certainly widely regarded as an important writer. It was great to be able to read one of his books while he was still alive and celebrate him. And if you're looking for an excuse to read Bend in the River or In a Free State, well, now you have it.
And if you're looking for an excuse to rate and review us in any of the podcast aggregators in which you can subscribe to this podcast, look no further. You should do it. There's no excuse needed, actually. You can just...
None.
Yeah, no. So you can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere that you collect your podcasts, you can subscribe to us and you can rate and review us. It does help us out. It helps other people find the show. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's newtv.com. You know, it's a real website, and you know how they kept saying it's new TV, but don't call it new TV because we're going to come up with a new name? Apparently, that's because there already is newtv.com, and it's literally a stealth R&D venture exploring better ways to create and distribute high-quality news, entertainment, and 3D holograph experiences. We're based in Silicon Valley. We're reimagining news, film, TV, and music. And no, we're not affiliated with Jeffrey Katzenberg or Meg Whitman. They never even call, and they do not invite us to fancy parties.
Is that what their website says?
Literally, Ralph Kettler, founder of New TV. It's literally the same sort of thing, you know, same area. And they are using that name, and they didn't even explore the fact that it's already taken and the website's taken and that somebody's doing, like, literally that, not 10-minute bursts as such, but like literally in the same playground with that name already taken. That's pretty ridiculous.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, and apparently you can't, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.